Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and this is part two of a two-part episode discussing the anthology of short stories by Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman, collectively known as The Second Generation, published in 1994 by TSR Incorporated. In the previous episode, we discussed three of the stories featured in this collection, all of which had previously been published in the Dragonlance Tales trilogy. In this episode, we are going to discuss the final two stories, both of which first appeared in this anthology. Afterwards, we'll discuss the book as a whole, so if you haven't listened to part one, you might want to. As usual, this episode will contain spoilers, so stop now if you'd rather read the stories first. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please support the show by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club. For $5 a month, you'll be helping to support the podcast, and you'll gain access to exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Right now, we're reading the Artifact Cycle series inspired by the world of Magic the Gathering, but that's only the beginning. If you have any questions or comments, please email me at dndbookclub@gmail.com or follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. Now, let's return to Kryn for the first of our stories, Kitiara's Son. Kitiara's Son begins, as so many Dragonlance stories do, at the inn of the last home in Solace. It's late at night and the owners of the inn, husband and wife, Caramon Magier and Tika Wayland Magier, are ready to close up. Their eldest sons, Tannen and Sturm, are off visiting the Quaishu Plainsmen, and the youngest son, Palin, is away at wizard boarding school. Their little daughters are asleep, and the couple is looking forward to a night to themselves. Right after locking up, their fun is ruined by a new arrival knocking at the door. It's a woman, traveling alone, and they let her inside. They are shocked to see that this woman is dressed in the blue dragon scale armor of a dragon rider, the kind of armor they haven't seen since the War of the Lance, 2 decades ago. But the woman herself is clearly not a warrior. She's middle-aged, tired, frightened, and is desperate to speak to Caramon. The woman introduces herself as Sarah Dunstan and proceeds to tell Caramon and Tika an unbelievable story. According to Sarah, during the years just prior to the War of the Lance, she was a young woman living on her own in Salamnia, in the general vicinity of the city of Palanthus. One night, a mysterious woman arrived at Sarah's door on the verge of death. She was Kitiara Uthmatar, a mercenary originally from Solace Township. She was pregnant, and the pregnancy was not proceeding well. As you know if you've read the previous novels or listened to previous episodes, Kitiara was once part of the group of adventurers we know as the Companions. She is also Caramon and Raisin Magier's older half-sister. She taught Caramon swordplay before she went off adventuring on her own. But she always returned to visit her brothers and later to visit her lover, Tanis Half-Elven. Kitiara was always something of an outsider, however. There was a streak of cruelty and callousness in her. When the Companions decided to separate 5 years prior to the War of the Lance, Kitiara traveled north to Salamnia on a mission to search for her missing father, a disgraced knight of Salamnia named Gregor Uthmatar. She traveled with Sturm Brightblade, also the child of a Salamnic knight, also on a quest to find his father. Caramon and Tika know this part of the story. What they do not know is the true story of what happened between Kitiara and Sturm during that time. Side note, the novel Darkness and Light by Paul B. Thompson and Tanya R. Carter from the Dragonlance Prelude series tells the story of Kitiara and Sturm's quest to find their fathers. Sarah tells them that Kitiara hated Sturm for being such an uptight prude and decided to seduce him to make him break his vow of celibacy before marriage. She succeeded and revealed to Sturm it had been all a joke to her. Sturm was humiliated and ashamed. The two separated and Kitiara went off on her own. Well, not quite on her own. She was carrying a little peanut with her. While Kitiara lay ill in Sarah's home, Sarah called for the local healer, a wise druidess. Kitiara demanded the druidess give her something to terminate the pregnancy, but the druidess refused. If Kitiara had an induced miscarriage now, it would kill her as well as the baby. Kitiara had no choice but to carry it to term. In time, the baby was born, a healthy boy. Kitiara, after recovering from labor, left the boy with Sarah to be raised as her own. Kitiara had dreams of military glory, and her ambition would lead her to become the most powerful dragon high lord on Ancelon, and a baby simply did not factor into her plans. Before she left, however, she bestowed the child with the name Steel. The rest is history. Kitiara joins the dragon armies and rises swiftly in rank. Sturm reunites with the companions and ultimately becomes the leader of the defenders during the assault on the High Claris Tower, as told in Dragons of Winter Night. Sturm dies defending the tower, slain by Kitiara herself, never knowing about his son. Kitiara herself would die during the Battle of Palanthas, killed by the dark elf wizard Dalimar. Meanwhile, Little Steel grew up in the city of Palanthas. Sarah raised him on stories of the heroics of Knights of Salamnia, including the sacrifice of Sturm Brightblade, and Steel dreamed of being a knight himself. But Steel was different from other children. There was an intensity to him that his would-be playmates found off-putting. The same darkness that had existed in the mother existed in the son. Steel grew up friendless and alone, although he hid the pain of his loneliness behind a proud exterior. Years after Kitiara's death, when Steel was a teenager, a man named Lord Ariokin appeared at Sarah Dunstan's door. Lord Ariokin was the son of Dragon High Lord Ariokis, who had been the supreme commander of the dragon armies during the War of the Lance. Ariokin, whose mother was supposedly the sea goddess Zeboim herself, fought during the War of the Lance, but was captured by the Knights of Salamnia. While a captive of the Knights, he earned their respect for his honorable conduct and his skill as a warrior. It was during this time that Ariokin had an epiphany. The dragon armies were defeated, not by the Knights of Salamnia, but by their own selfishness. Evil turns in upon itself, as the golden discs of Mishakal say. Once he was released by the Knights, Ariokin undertook a pilgrimage to Naraka, the holy city of Tachesis. Ariokin became trapped in the snowy mountains. Near the point of death, he received guidance from his divine mother. After finding shelter in a cave, he fell unconscious and had a vision of the Queen of Darkness herself. He told the Queen that he sought to create a new military order, fanatically loyal to her, capable of conquering Ancelon, which will be structured from the ground up to avoid the mistakes of the past. Rather than encouraging personal ambition and greed among the troops, as the High Lords did during the War of the Lance, Ariokin will encourage loyalty, discipline, sacrifice, and most importantly of all, personal devotion to the Dark Queen herself. Tachesis, seeing the merits in Ariokin's plan, grants him leave to found this new order in her name. That is why Ariokin has come to Steel's door, to recruit this young man, the son of the legendary Kitiara Uthmatar, to become a knight of Tachesis. Sarah was horrified at this idea. She had tried for years to steer the boy away from his mother's path and onto his father's path. But the Knights of Tachesis offered Steel a place to belong, an organization whose tenets and discipline might help him to learn to balance the darkness and light within his own soul. There was no way he would refuse such an offer. Unwilling to let Steel sacrifice himself to evil, Sarah offered to come along, to work for the knighthood as civilian support personnel. Ariokin agreed, and the two began their new life. In the years since, Steel has risen through the ranks of the knighthood, although not as swiftly as some of his comrades, despite his skill and his devotion. Unknown to all except Sarah herself, it is Sarah's influence over Steel that has held him back, preventing him from committing himself fully to the Dark Queen. But that time is at an end. Steel is on the verge of taking the Blood Oath, the vow that will make him a full Knight of Tachesis. There are three orders within the knighthood, the martial order called the Knights of the Lily, the magical order called the Knights of the Thorn, and the clerical order called the Knights of the Skull. Steel, a born warrior, will join the first of the three orders as a junior officer. Sarah has come to Caramon out of a desperate desire to prevent Steele from giving his soul to Dekesis. She believes that if Steele learns the truth about who his father is, he may decide to renounce evil. Sarah wants Caramon to come with her to Storm's Keep, the headquarters of the Dark Knights, and then to bring Steele to the High Claris Tower to commune with the spirit of his father, who was interred there many years ago. Caramon agrees to go along with Sarah's plan. Steele is his nephew, after all, not to mention the son of one of his dearest friends. But Caramon knows they will need more help. He convinces Sarah that they must make a stop along the way to pick up Tanis Half-Elven. Sarah agrees and the two depart, flying off on Sarah's blue dragon, Flare. Caramon has another reason for wanting to bring Tanis along. As Kitiara's former lover, Caramon suspects there may be a chance that Steele is actually Tanis's son, and that Kitiara's story about seducing Sturm was a lie. Caramon and Sarah arrive at Tanis's house and tell him the story. We get to see Lorana for the first time since Dragons of Spring Dawning, although she doesn't have a single line of dialogue, and we get to meet Tanis's son for the first time, although he doesn't get a name yet. Tanis fears Sarah may be leading them into a trap, but Tanis agrees to go along anyway, for the same reasons as Caramon, but also to learn as much as he can about these Dark Knights. Tanis, Caramon, and Sarah arrive at Storm's Keep, a remote island surrounded by a perpetual tempest, which can only be reached by magical means or on dragonback. They manage to sneak into the knight's encampment and to Sarah's modest home. In case you're wondering how they managed to infiltrate this highly defended, highly isolated fortress, and in case you're wondering why the blue dragon Flare is going along with all this, Sarah is using the ruse that Caramon and Tanis are spies being brought to Lord Ariakan for debriefing. Apparently, Flare is so loyal to Sarah that she is willing to believe anything Sarah tells her. Tanis and Caramon hide while Steele arrives at Sarah's house for Sunday dinner. Upon first seeing Steele, the two friends realize immediately that this young man is definitely Kitiara's son, and definitely not Tanis's. However, it's not immediately obvious whether he is truly a Brightblade. Sarah tries one last time to convince Steele to leave the knighthood, but he refuses. She has no choice but to use the old sleeping potion in the stew trick to render Steele unconscious. Tanis and Caramon sneak Steele back to the dragon stables and throw Steele on Flare's back, and they all set off for the High Claris Tower. Again, Flare just goes along with it. The group arrives in the foothills near the High Claris Tower, stronghold of the virtuous Knights of Salamnia, as Steele regains consciousness. At first, he's furious about being drugged and kidnapped by his own mother, as anyone would be, but he quickly gains control of his emotions. He knows who Tanis Half-Elven and his uncle Caramon Majir are. Even among the Knights of Dekesis, they are honored for their bravery and skill as warriors. Here at last, Steele is told the true identity of his father, the knowledge of whom Steele has never pursued, as he was warned by Lord Ariakan that it would be a curse upon Steele to know the truth. Steele is deeply moved by this revelation. Sturm, like Tanis and Caramon, is honored by the Knights of Dekesis for the sacrifice he made. In fact, Sturm had long been a personal hero of Steele's. Steele hides the effect that the discovery of his true lineage has on him behind a mask of haughty pride, however. Steele agrees to go with Tanis and Caramon to the High Claris Tower to pay his respects to his father. He reasons that he will be able to learn much about the tower's defenses, which he can report back to Lord Ariakan. Sarah remains behind with Flare. The plan hits an immediate snag. Steele is wearing black armor decorated with symbols of evil, the skull and the death lily. One does not simply walk into the High Claris Tower in such regalia. Steele flat out refuses to disguise who and what he is. Steele smugly declares that if the god Paladine wants him in his holy tower, he can figure out how to make it happen. Paladine, the supreme god of good, calls Steele's bluff, apparently. The knights guarding the tower see Steele as just another young knight of Salamnia, no different than any other. Steele and the two older men are even given a formal escort into the Chamber of Paladine, the sacred tomb beneath the tower, where Sturm Brightblade and the other heroes who died defending the tower against Steele's mother are interred. Sturm's body lays upon a bier in the center of the tomb. The magic of the Star Jewel, an elven artifact given to him long ago by Princess Alhanna Starbreeze, has prevented his body from decaying. Tanis and Caramon each pay their respects to their fallen friend. Then, as Steele approaches his father, there is a blinding flash of light, and a vision of Sturm appears. He gives his son the very Star Jewel he wears around his neck. When the vision departs, the body of Sturm is gone, and the illusion of Steele as a knight of Salamnia is broken. The knights who escorted the trio into the tomb see Steele for what he truly is and attack. Steele takes his father's sword, a sword no warrior dedicated to evil should be able to touch, let alone wield, to defend himself. Tanis and Caramon come to Steele's aid, and together they are able to escape from the High Claris Tower. They reunite with Sarah and Flare and escape from pursuit. The silver dragons, which usually guard the skies around the tower, see them but do not engage. Once they reach safety, Steele goes off on his own to think things over and to commune with his goddess. Finally, he reaches a decision. He will return to Storm's Keep, and he will take the Blood Oath, which will allow him to become a Knight of the Lily. Sarah is heartbroken, but there is nothing she can do to sway him. Steele bids farewell to Tanis and Caramon and returns home. Back at the island fortress, Steele spends the night in prayer to Dekesis before finally taking his oath before the High Priestess of the Knights of the Skull. The High Priestess sees the elven jewel Steele wears and knows that his soul is not fully committed to the Dark Queen. Nevertheless, she grants him his knighthood, warning him that the Dark Queen will always be watching him and that, one way or another, she will have his soul in the end. Once she is gone, Steele begins to remove the jewel, but stops himself. Instead, he chooses to wear it under his armor as a reminder of his father. The ceremony complete, Steele greets his brothers and his lord, dressed in his new armor, armor blessed by Dekesis herself, the ancient sword of the Brightblade family at his side. Part 2, The Sacrifice. The sacrifice begins in the city of Palanthas, where we are introduced to a brand new character, Mistress Jenna. Jenna is a human wizardess of the Order of the Red Robes. She is also the daughter of Gestarius, the current head of the Wizards Conclave in Weyrith. She runs a successful mage ware shop in the city, selling magical artifacts, scrolls, spell components, etc. to mages of all three orders. One evening, a few years after the events described in Kitiara's Son, Mistress Jenna is closing up for the night when she receives two mysterious visitors. Both are high-born elves, although she is able to discern from their accents that one is from the nation of Sylvanesti and one is from Qualinesti. Now for a little bit of lore. Once upon a time, there was one nation of elves, Sylvanesti. The nation split in two when a group of elves left Sylvanesti to found their own kingdom, Qualinesti. For centuries, there was enmity between the two races of elves. That enmity nearly turned to violence during the War of the Lance. After the war, however, the Qualinesti prince Porthios led his warriors into Sylvanesti to free the land from the evil which had inhabited it during the war. For his efforts, he was hailed as a hero among both kingdoms. When his father died, Porthios became Speaker of the Sun, the king of the Qualinesti. He married Alhanna Starbreeze, queen of the Sylvanesti, daughter of the late Speaker of the Stars, king of the Sylvanesti. Their marriage was a political alliance to unite the two separate elven kingdoms into one cohesive state. There are hardline conservative factions within both nations, however, who want things to go back to the way they were. That is why these two elves, representatives of those factions, have come to find Mistress Jenna. They seek an audience with Dalimar, himself an exile from Sylvanesti. Mistress Jenna happens to be Dalimar's lover and has a direct line to the Dark Elf. The next evening, Dalimar arrives at Jenna's shop to meet these two conspirators. They tell Dalimar that Porthios, king of the Qualinesti, has been imprisoned in Sylvanesti, while Alhanna, queen of the Sylvanesti, has been imprisoned in Qualinesti. Alhanna has become pregnant by her husband, and the child born to them would rule both kingdoms as Speaker of the Sun and Stars. The two nations would be fully united under one ruler for the first time since the Kinslayer Wars. The Old Guard elves will do anything to prevent this from happening. That's where Dalimar comes in. The elven traitors have a plan to remove the child of Porthos and Alhanna from the line of succession. Achieving this goal will not be simple, however. They foresee that the legendary hero, Tanis Half-Elven, will do everything in his power to stop their plan from succeeding. The conspirators need Dalimar to prevent Tanis from interfering. Dalimar listens to their plan and agrees to help. Meanwhile, Tanis is facing the greatest battle he has ever known, raising a teenage son. Gilthas, his son by the elven princess Larana, the younger sister of Porthos, was weak and sickly during his youth, prone to debilitating headaches. He's grown stronger and healthier, but his doting parents still treat him like a fragile little bird. He is chafing under the overprotective guardianship of his parents and resents them both, especially his father. Gilthas is, of course, a quarter human, and although he appears fully elven, he has much of his father's restless, wandering spirit in him. Gilthas has heard stories of Caramon Majir's sons, the two knights in training, Tannin and Sturm, and the apprentice wizard, Palin. Gilthas desperately wants to be allowed to go out and see the world, as the Majir boys are. Most of all, he wants to visit his ancestral homeland, Quellen Esti, which his parents refuse to allow. During a typical argument with his parents, Gilthas reveals that he has been invited to visit Quellen Esti by an elven senator named Rashas, who is staying at a local inn. As anticipated, his father says no. Tanis doesn't tell Gilthas, but he knows how the pure-blooded elves treat those of mixed parentage. He is only trying to spare the young man from mistreatment and embarrassment. Gilthas, not understanding this at all, is furious and decides to sneak out on his own. Gilthas is traveling alone towards the inn when a pair of griffins appear in the sky and land in front of him. One of the riders is none other than Senator Rashas himself, along with the senator's Cagan Esti servant. The senator leaves behind his servant to tend to Gilthas's horse, while he and Gilthas mount the griffins and take flight towards Quellen Esti. When they at last reach the elven kingdom, Gilthas marvels at the beauty of his native country and its capital city, Quellen Ost. He has dreamed of visiting his entire life, and now that he is here, he is overwhelmed. The senator takes Gilthas to meet a very special person, Queen Alhanna Starbreeze. Gilthas is starstruck, pun intended, but his excitement quickly evaporates. Clearly, there is a tension between the senator and the queen. Gilthas realizes that something is very wrong with this situation. His fears are confirmed when the senator leaves Gilthas with his aunt, both guarded by Cagan Esti elves, as prisoners in their own land. Alhanna explains to Gilthas what is happening. Senator Rashas is the leader of the conservative Quellen Esti faction, which is attempting to oust the legitimate rulers of both nations. He plans to condemn Porthos and Alhanna as traitors and exile them from elven lands. Elves do not have capital punishment, so this is the harshest punishment available to them, to label Porthos and Alhanna as dark elves for all time. Their child will never be able to sit the throne. Instead, Gilthas will be made Speaker of the Sun and Stars. Except for his mother, who cannot rule because she's married to a half-elf, Gilthas is the last descendant of the late Speaker of the Sun. Technically, Gilthas's human blood should disqualify him from ruling, but the senator and his cronies actually see this as a positive. They think all humans are weak and stupid, and that Gilthas will be easy to manipulate. Rashas plans to rule Quellen Esti himself, using Gilthas as his puppet. During the night, an elven warrior named Samar attempts to infiltrate Quellen Ost and rescue Queen Alhanna. The plan nearly succeeds, but is foiled by the senator's Cagan Esti warriors. Samar is taken prisoner, and Gilthas is separated from his aunt. The next morning, he is fed and dressed by a beautiful young Cagan Esti woman. Once the young woman is gone, Gilthas changes from his speaker robes into his normal clothes. He has decided he will thwart the senator's plan by refusing to take the oath which will elevate him to the throne. Upon discovering what Gilthas intends, Rashas lashes out furiously, insulting Gilthas and his father, calling them half-breeds, and calling his mother a whore. He orders one of the Cagan Esti guards to beat Gilthas, then drags him to the room where Alhanna is being held prisoner. The senator orders one of his Cagan Esti warriors to aim an arrow at the queen's head. The senator has tried the carrot, and now he's trying the stick. If Gilthas refuses to become speaker, his aunt will be murdered. Gilthas has no choice but to submit. The morning after Gilthas sneaks off, Lorana wakes Tanis to tell him that Gilthas is gone. Tanis, knowing about the letter from the senator, decides to follow Gilthas to the Black Swan Inn. Since their most recent fight, Tanis has cooled off and begun to realize that perhaps it is time for Gilthas to gain some real-world experience. Tanis remembers how he was at that age, how he ran away from his home to join up with the dwarf Flint Fireforge. Tanis has decided it's time for some man-to-man talk and hopefully a fresh start for their relationship. Along the road, however, Tanis stumbles across a disturbing scene. It appears there was an ambush. Investigating further, Tanis encounters draconians in the woods. Thinking that these draconians had surprised and captured, possibly even killed his son, Tanis prepares to attack. He is surprised when Dalimar appears, urging Tanis to stand down. Dalimar takes Tanis to the Tower of High Sorcery in Palanthas and tells him what Rashas and his faction are plotting. Dalimar also reveals that he himself has been recruited to stop Tanis from becoming involved. But Dalimar, as usual, has plans of his own. Dalimar is a loyal follower of T'Kesis, the Queen of Darkness, and she does not want the son of Tanis Half-Elven and Princess Lorana ruling over the elves. Although Rashas has a low opinion of Tanis and Lorana, the Dark Queen does not. She is planning another full-scale attack on Ancelon, spearheaded by the Knights of T'Kesis, and fears the ascension of Gilthas to the throne of the United Elven Kingdoms. Dalimar offers to help Tanis rescue Gilthas from Qualinos and return him home. Rescuing Gilthas will not only mean the young man's safety from these dangerous new politics, but it will also mean that the alliance between the elves and the other races of Kryn, an alliance which Lorana and Tanis have worked tirelessly to organize, an alliance which Rashas and his faction oppose, will be secure. The alliance between humans, elves, and dwarves will be a bulwark against the Dark Knights. Without the elves, the alliance itself will fall apart. Dalimar magically whisks them away to Qualin Esti, just in time for the convening of the Elven Senate, the Thalassenthia. Hidden by Dalimar's magic, Tanis and Dalimar watch as Rashas announces that Porthios has been accused of treason by the Senate, and that the Senate has decided he is guilty. The heads of households, the lesser governing body dominated by younger elves with more modern ideas, objects to this bald-faced power play. They demand Porthios be allowed to speak in his own defense. Rashas claims that Porthios was offered that chance, but declined to be present, neglecting to mention that Porthios is currently in prison in Sylvan Esti. Rashas also informs the gathered nobles that Porthios willingly removed his medallion of office, a medallion which cannot be removed by force, and that Gilthas now wears the medallion. Again, Rashas neglects to mention that Porthios removed the medallion only to save his wife. Rashas announces that Gilthas, the son of Lorelanthalassa of the House of Solastarin, will be the new speaker. The younger elves again object, since Gilthas is not fully human, but Rashas claims that modern problems require modern solutions. He has essentially tricked the lower house into an untenable position. They have no choice but to go along with this plan for now. As Gilthas is about to take the vow that will make him speaker, Tanis reveals himself and attempts to take Gilthanas away with him. To his surprise, Gilthas refuses. He is a man now, capable of making his own decisions, and he has decided to stay in Qualin Esti and take the throne. Tanis reverts to his old ways, treating Gilthas like a child, but his son is defiant. He will remain. The senator's guards advance on Tanis, but before Tanis can be captured, Dalimar magics them both away. Tanis and Dalimar arrive at the home of Senator Rashas, where Alhanna Starbreeze is being held captive. Together, they manage to overpower the Qualin Esti guards and rescue the queen. Before they can escape, Rashas appears with yet more guards. He declares Alhanna to be a dark elf and banishes her from all elven lands. He likewise forbids Tanis from ever setting foot in Qualin Esti. He also reminds Tanis that his son is now under his control. If Tanis does anything to threaten Rashas' rule in Qualin Esti, Gilthas may meet with an untimely accident. There is nothing Tanis can do. Well, there is one thing he can do. Tanis punches Rashas in the face. Then he, Alhanna, and Dalimar depart. On the outskirts of Qualin Esti land, the group separates. Alhanna travels with Samar, also released from captivity, to Sylvan Esti to attempt to rescue her husband. Dalimar and Tanis are about to depart themselves when suddenly Gilthas appears, escorted by an elven magic user. He has managed to convince his keepers to allow him to confirm that Alhanna is safe and to say a final goodbye to his father. Tanis tells Gilthas that, under elven law, he cannot be coerced into becoming speaker. He can renounce his title now that Alhanna is safe. Gilthas explains that the defiance he showed when Tanis attempted to rescue him was an act, put on to convince Roshas that he is now fully on board. In fact, Gilthas has come to believe that this is the part Destiny has chosen for him to play, as Destiny once chose Tanis half-elven many years ago. Gilthas may be the Senate's puppet for now, but they will always underestimate him, and he will be able to use his position to do good in the world, despite their best efforts. Tanis is overcome with pride. He realizes that Gilthas, despite his elven appearance and despite his physical weakness, is very much his father's son at heart. Father and son say their farewells and separate, each walking his own path towards a future darker and more dangerous than either could possibly imagine. War is coming to Ancelon once again, and the fight against the Knights of Tachesis will be a mere prelude of the ultimate battle to come. A battle in which good and evil, mortal and divine, will be forced to unite against the greatest enemy Kryn has ever faced. Alright, so that was the second generation. I hope you liked the two-episode format. I found there were so many characters and so many stories weaving in and out of one another, it was impossible to cover the entire book in a single, easily digestible episode. Let me know what you think. Let's take a few minutes to discuss this anthology as a whole. What works, what doesn't, which stories are worth reading, and which are worth skipping. Before we dive in, though, I want to read an excerpt from the beginning of the book, a foreword supposedly written by the wizard Fizban, avatar of the god Paladine. A long time ago, a couple of doorknobs named Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman decided to leave their homes on Kryn and go out adventuring. I'm afraid there's some Kender blood in those two. They just couldn't resist traipsing off to visit other new and exciting worlds. But Weiss and Hickman are like Kender and Bad Pennies, they keep turning up. And so here they are again, all set to tell us some of the wonderful things that are happening in Kryn. Some of these stories we've heard before, but they have a couple of new ones too. All about the children of that small band of adventurers who are now known as the Heroes of the Lance. Many years have passed since the war. The heroes' children are growing up, going off in adventures of their own, heading out into a world that, I'm sorry to say, still has plenty of danger and trouble left to go around. Now, as you read these stories, you will notice that sometimes Weiss and Hickman contradict certain other stories you may have heard. Some of you might find yourselves more than a little perplexed over their accounts of the heroes' past lives, accounts that differ from other accounts. There is a perfectly simple explanation. Following the War of the Lance, Tanis and Caramon and Raistlin and all the rest of the companions stopped being ordinary people and became legends. We liked hearing about the heroes' adventures so much we didn't want the stories to end. We wanted to hear more. To fill the demand, bards and legend spinners came from all over Kryn to tell the wondrous tales. Some of these knew the heroes well, others simply repeated stories they'd heard told by a dwarf, who had heard it from a kender, who borrowed it from a knight, who had an aunt who knew the heroes. You get the picture. Some of these stories are absolutely, positively true. Others are probably almost absolutely positively true, but not quite. Still, others are what we refer to in polite society as kender tales. Stories that aren't true, but sure are a hoot to hear. And so you ask, Fizban, great and powerful wizard, which stories are which? And I, Fizban, great and powerful wizard, answer, as long as you enjoyed the stories, you doorknob, what does it matter? So, from the get-go, we know there are going to be issues of canon. Some of these stories are considered canonical and some aren't. Some are only canonical in part. I can't tell you which is which without spoiling the next book, so I won't. But just keep in mind that not everything I've told you is true. We have four stories about the children of the Heroes of the Lance and a fifth story, Raistlin's Daughter, which is kind of an outlier. Despite the title, it's not actually about Raistlin's daughter. It probably should have been called Raistlin's Baby Mama if they wanted to be more accurate. I have mixed feelings about this story. There's nothing wrong with it exactly. It's a fairly straightforward narrative which takes place in a single night, and it has a fun little twist at the end. At least, it's fun if you know the story of the Irda and how they split from the race of ogres millennia ago. It's also funny imagining anyone being so infatuated with a golden jerk who can't seem to stop coughing up blood, but I guess that's one of the drawbacks of Erda sex magic. The flaw in the story is in the introduction. There's a brief note, supposedly written by Caramon Magier, claiming that this story is pure rumor. He denies that these events took place or that Raistlin fathered a daughter. Of course, he wouldn't know, since his mind was wiped along with Raistlin's, but the story's legs are cut out from beneath it before it even begins. If this story is just a retelling of a rumor, why should we care? The second story we discussed, The Legacy, is probably the highlight of the entire collection. We meet some new characters, Tannen and Stern Magier, and, most importantly, Palin, as well as being reunited with some fan favorites, Caramon and Dalimar. We learn a bit of the aftermath of Raistlin's death or not death in the Abyss, how it impacted Caramon, and how Caramon was able to make peace with what had happened. We also learn that, despite that peace, Palin's pursuit of magic has opened old wounds in Caramon's soul. The tension between Palin and Caramon feels genuine. Palin wants to be the dutiful son, but he has a destiny that he must follow. Caramon wants to keep his son safe, the way he failed to keep his brother safe. It seems to me to be a fairly universal story about a bond between a father and son and what it means to allow a child to grow up and go off on his own. Assuming you've listened to part one, you know that what Palin experiences in the Tower of High Sorcery is all a fabrication, a part of his test. But, as you're reading it, the danger feels very real. Raistlin is threatening the world once again, and Palin must choose between an unconscionable act of evil and his own life. I'm sure we all like to imagine we'd be willing to sacrifice ourselves to save millions, but would we really? Palin knows he has it within him to make that impossible choice. The revelation at the end that this was all an illusion, that it was all a dream, so to speak, doesn't feel cheap or unearned. The characters have been discussing Palin's test since the beginning of the story. Dragonlance readers know that, to the young wizard being tested, it feels as real as it gets, so it's understandable why Palin never realizes what's happening until the end. Palin is given the staff of Magius, and the characters are all left to wonder, if it was all an illusion, then who gave it to him? It's a twist upon a twist, a rarity within the typically straightforward narrative of a Dragonlance story, and it leaves the future very uncertain and leaves many mysteries yet to be explored. Then we come to Wanna Bet, the second of the Magier Boy stories, although it's the first one in which Tannen and Stern play a real role. Ultimately, however, it's the Palin show again. Tannen and Stern simply aren't interesting characters. There's almost no way to tell them apart. They're warriors, they want to be knights, they like to drink and flirt, and that's about it. Dugan Redhammer is a likable character, and the revelation at the end that he is actually the god Reorx in disguise is nifty, although it doesn't pack nearly the punch of the revelation of Fizban as Paladine. I think perhaps Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman were trying to pull off a magic trick we'd already seen, and it just doesn't land with the same force. I think I like this story the least of all the stories because it's very silly. We've got a bunch of gnomes sailing an impractical monstrosity of a ship, savage warriors playing Mr. Mom, the Magier brothers losing their clothes in games of dice and continuing on their quest in their underwear, and we've got the wizard Gargath transforming into all kinds of ridiculous creatures. It simply isn't a tone which appeals to me as a reader. If you like wacky adventures, you might enjoy it more than I did, but I will almost always prefer drama to comedy. That brings us to the first story of part two, Kitiara's Son. If you'd asked me what my favorite story of this collection was before I reread it for this episode, I probably would have said it was this one. I can't say too much without spoiling the next book, but I have a major soft spot for Steel, and I love the Knights of Tachesis in general. In remembering the story, however, I was really remembering it as the story of the founding of the Knights of Tachesis, and I was likewise remembering it as the story of Steel's conception, birth, youth, and induction into the ranks of the Knights. That's the part of the story I like, and it's not even all part of the actual story. A lot of it is covered in an appendix at the end of the book, rather than within the story itself. For example, almost all of Ariakon's time as a captive of the Salamnic Knights and his odyssey to Naraka are told in the appendix. Essentially, the present-day story can be boiled down thus. Caramon meets Sarah, Caramon and Tannis kidnap Steel from Storm's Keep, they go to the High Claris Tower where Sturm appears as a spirit, and then they leave. Except for the scene within the Chamber of Paladine, most of the present-day narrative is pretty thin. It's not a bad story, but it doesn't have a lot of meat on it. If this were TV, the story might be something like a backdoor pilot, introducing the Knights of Tachesis in preparation for the novel to come. Regardless, it is still a favorite of mine, simply because I love Dark Paladins as a concept, and Steel in particular. Lastly, we come to The Sacrifice. Now, if you had asked me which story was my least favorite of this collection before I reread it for this episode, I probably would have said it was this one. My opinion, however, has changed. With the possible exception of The Legacy, I think this is the strongest story in the book. It's a little slow to start. I'm not sure the scene between Mistress Jenna and the two elves is entirely necessary, except to introduce Jenna as a character, but once it gets going, it maintains a steady pace. We get some good political intrigue, something which rarely features in Dragonlance stories. It's fairly convincing, too. We've been told for 6 novels now how the elves distrust and dislike the other races, that they prefer isolation, and that elves are resistant to change of any kind. It makes sense, therefore, that many would oppose Porthos' efforts at modernization and expansion. Rashus is a terrific villain. He's the kind of slimy, smirking, double-dealing politician we all know and hate. At first, he seems like this cold-hearted manipulator who is simply trying to game the system for his own gain. But when Gilfest refuses to do as Rashus orders, and Rashus launches into a furious rant, we see the real man behind the calculating exterior. Not a man dedicated to preserving the traditions of his people, but a man no different at heart than any other racist or misogynist. I very much enjoy the relationship between Tanis and Gilthas. The two are very different, yet also very alike. Tanis grew up as an outcast and had to survive on his own in a harsh and unforgiving world. These hardships made him into the man he is. Gilthas, on the other hand, grew up sheltered and protected and doted upon. He has never experienced any of the hardships that often build character in a young man. Tanis wants to protect his son, but he cannot truly relate to him. Gilthas, of course, is bitter towards his father for denying him all the experiences that a young man is supposed to have. How can he grow up to be a great man like his father if he is never given the chance? By the end of the story, however, both Tanis and Gilthas have come to understand one another. Gilthas has experienced deceit and danger and found the courage to sacrifice his own wants for the good of the world. Likewise, Tanis realizes that Gilthas is no longer a child and that he must be allowed to pursue his destiny. There are a lot of parallels in the relationship between Gilthas and Tanis and between Palin and Caramon in The Legacy, and I think the two stories complement one another very well. All right, that's all for this episode, and that's all for this year. Hosting this podcast has truly been one of the brightest spots of an otherwise gloomy year, and I look forward to all the stories we'll be reading together in the year to come. I hope you'll join me in 2021 when we will be discussing the grand finale to the Chronicles saga, Dragons of Summer Flame. As usual, if you want to support the podcast and get access to exclusive premium episodes, visit patreon.com/DandBookClub. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. Until next time, thanks for listening, and have a happy and safe new year.